Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
A lifeline. Bruno Fernandes steps up for Manchester United and the pressure eases after a truly demoralising week. Derby defeat preceded a dismantling at the hands of Newcastle United in the Carabao Cup. And Old Trafford, to be honest, hasn't felt quite as glum as that for many moons. Q, a trip to Fulham, often a useful antidote for United. And Q, another late winner at Craven Cottage and proper limbs in the away end for a 91st minute winner from Fernandes. Thank you very much. We'll take that. A very warm welcome to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast with me, Harry Robinson and Jack Tate. As always, thank you for joining us. Appreciate you choosing to spend your time in our company. We'll obviously talk about the Fulham game. We will also talk about the Newcastle game in midweek. And it feels like there isn't quite so much detail to pick out from these games because of what feels like a dearth of kind of tactical innovation from Erik ten Hag and some, but there is lots of big picture things to discuss, including whether this, after many of them already, like Brentford and McTominay before, will this be a moment to kick on for the season or will it be another false dawn? And we'll discuss that. But Jack, I always feel it would be wrong to dive into any kind of big picture analysis without appreciating just last minute winners are brilliant, aren't they? It's always a buzz. And for match going Reds, who'd seen the two defeats at home to Newcastle and City, and we've had a couple of moments on the road that looked great, like Garnacho at Arsenal, but then been ruled out. A lot of false dawns and some two very depressing back-to-back games. This was needed. It was a great day in isolation, a great day out on the banks of the River Thames. And yeah, last minute winners at Craven Cottage always feel good.
I think there's probably one truly redeeming quality about this football club at the moment, and that is without a doubt the away fans. Every single game, they are just unflinchingly incredible. And it was the same again at Fulham. And they were not the Craven Cottage as the loudest ground in the country, but United fans were making all the noise in that stadium for pretty much the entire game. And I think when the goal went in, obviously you're happy for yourself, but to be honest, I was just happy for all those fans that had made the trip down to London and had, you know, shown their support for a team that looked really void of ideas. And then the scenes in the away end after it went in, all the way through stoppage time, it was just incredible. It's just, we mentioned it after the Brentford game. These are the kind of moments that make you love and make you remember why you love football.
Yeah. It was interesting because I saw a couple of people who were at the game, including Pete Boyle, who's always a good barometer of these things, saying that it felt like a good away end, but not incredible. But everyone who was watching on TV commented on how brilliant it was. And I agree, I couldn't get a ticket, so I wasn't there. I would have loved to be because Fulham's always a good away day. But watching on TV, it sounded amazing right from the off. And then there was a great Calypso, United Calypso, going from, I can't remember exactly, probably 70, 75 minutes, which is a good chance. Oh, it's most people's favourite anyway, but it's a great chance to turn to when very little is happening on the pitch because you could just, it can just roll on and on and on. And it often does. I remember it might have been one of my first aways at Fulham. When I really fell in love with kind of away day culture was a United Calypso going on for, I think, probably the first 25, 30 minutes of the game. And I thought, this is just mint. And at the home games against Newcastle and City, it was kind of this defiant Calypso in the final 15 or 20 minutes, certainly in the Stretford end. It's a song to fit all occasions. But anyway, Pete Boyle was saying maybe it's something to do with the microphones, the way that they're set up at Craven Cottage, because it sounded incredible on TV. But to be honest, it's less about how loud it is and more about just the fact that 70, 75 minutes in what had been a game that didn't really deserve either team to score particularly, kind of a game that looked as if it deserved to be 0-0. That Calypso was ongoing. And I thought that the whole day was great. I thought the kids holding up the banner play, like you mean, it's fantastic. It's exactly the kind of, it's the perfect way to kind of oversee the standards of the players. It's nothing abusive. It's nothing petty. Just a banner held up in the warm up, so the players know, like, play like you mean it. And then I don't know if everyone would have seen in the picture, but in the bottom right corner it said up the Reds as well. So it was a very well balanced. I thought, I loved that. Yeah, delighted for everyone who was there. What a buzz! Just the best feeling. I think it's also worth talking about before we move on that, I guess this is kind of big picture stuff. And after the game against Newcastle on Wednesday, I was chatting to a couple of mates on the tram, and they were kind of getting into the players saying they just don't care. And I was saying, I just don't think that's the case. This, we have watched United teams in the past where you thought these lot have down tools. And we saw it under Mourinho, we saw it under Solskjaer, we've seen it under most managers, certainly under Radnick. I just haven't had that sense under Ten Hag at any point. They look confused sometimes and bad sometimes and whiny sometimes, but I've never felt it's not about caring. And I think United are really poor at the moment, and there's no denying that, but there is obvious kind of determination there to put things right. It just feels like so much of it's misplaced at the moment from the players. But Pulisic coming on was fantastic and made that goal. And that, have you seen the photo of Bruno Fernandes amidst the celebrations?
No, I haven't. Which one are you talking about?
It's Garnacho's kind of on his left, Maguire's on his right, Dalot's screaming into the away end, and a couple of other players around. And Bruno's just got his eyes closed, kind of leaning back. He looks a tired man, a properly under pressure man. It's an incredible photo for the kind of emotions it conveys. But you look at Fernandes, I'll send it to you after. You look at Fernandes and you think that like, I can't imagine the kind of weight of pressure that must come off in a moment like that.
Yeah,
he looks like a man made anxious by the expectation. And that would make most people crumble, and it never has to Bruno Fernandes. So it's a credit to him. And in a moment of kind of, well, certainly, yeah, a moment of chaos at the end, he was the calm in that chaos and won us the game. It was fantastic. But my wider point about this isn't about the players not caring. Do you agree on that? Or do you think they're just missing a little bit of something?
100%. I don't. The only time I've ever felt any sort of lack of care and effort was at times during the second half against Man City last week. And to be honest, I don't think that was a lack of caring, really. I think it was just a group of players, honestly, that were completely out of ideas and didn't know. They just wanted to be off the pitch. But I don't think that was because they didn't care. I think it was just because they had no idea how to stop what was happening on the
pitch.
Yeah,
and in fairness, that is a problem.
No, yeah,
I think there's a certain percentage missing. I don't know what number you can put on it. At times, there is a certain something missing, whether it's because of a lack of confidence, a lack of clarity in the game plan, or the kind of past traumas that they've suffered at the hands of City and Liverpool and whoever else. I think there's something missing sometimes. I don't think it's about caring, but I think it is a problem.
I think what it is that when... Like, I don't think you can say that this team isn't resilient when things are going badly. I mean, you only have to look at how many late goals we've scored this season. We do keep... But listen, I'm going to add okay. more to it, which I think might address what you're getting at. In general, I don't think this team isn't resilient. Look, the amount of late goals we've scored this season is a marker of that. What I think is a problem, though, is that when we feel that the game is sort of out of reach, then I think the resiliency completely goes. And that's why you see some of these games against Man City and Liverpool that realistically should probably have been 2-3-0 maybe. They escalate to conceding 4-5-6-7. And that for me was the case against Man City last week, where it got to a point where the players lost all their belief that we could even get anywhere near back into this game. And then there's potentially, I think, the one thing you can level at this team is that there maybe isn't a level of sort of pride.
Absolutely.
That even when you're going to lose the game, there isn't enough there to say, hang on, this isn't good enough. I want to get off this pitch being able to at least, feel not embarrassed by the performance we're putting out here. And that's where it's sometimes...
Yeah, but that isn't resilience, isn't it? Like, you look at the Newcastle game, which we'll talk a bit more about later as well, but United came out for the second half and showed passion and desire and a determination to put things right from the first half. We were 2-0 down, but their developed a belief inside Old Trafford that actually maybe we can come back from this because the team were attacking. They weren't doing it with great quality. There were lots of wasted chances, but I know a few corners, but they were doing the right thing. Third goal goes in, it's gone. And it's only the 60th minute or so. I can't remember exactly, but around the hour mark. But it all went. And they just didn't really bother after that. And that's not resilience. And the other thing I'll say, I was for a bit of research on a piece I'm doing for the programme, I was reading the chapter about Billy Garton, who played for United in the 80s, arguably the academy graduate to have been born closest to Old Trafford. He was born and grew up on the same estate as Eddie Coleman did in Audsall in Salford. And he talks about how Ron Atkinson would use him in the 80s because there was this idea at United in the 80s that there wasn't that sense of pride from the players. There wasn't that sense of kind of passion, and people didn't realise how much it meant to wear the United shirt. And so Ron Atkinson would use him to give team talks for games such as against Manchester City. And he would talk about how much it meant to the people of Manchester and Salford to win over City. And reading it, I was struck at how kind of familiar that sounds. And there are times where you think McTominay can offer that, but and the players are very happy to buy into that when we win, but there does seem a serious, you do watch the games against City and Newcastle and you think, where is your pride? How are you letting this happen? Ultimately, I don't think it's the biggest issue at United, even on the pitch. I think that the complete lack of a plan, and that's down to the manager as well as the players, is more of an issue, but it is a problem.
I don't think this team is playing badly because they don't care or because they're not putting the effort, or even that they're not resilient. I think there is some resiliency there. Like, I agree with you, I don't think it's perfect. But in general, I think this is a relatively resilient team. I just don't think we're very good. That's about much more than that.
Yeah. You can't call this team resilient when every time we concede, they've admitted that when we concede, they don't know what to do anymore and they forget the game plan.
But do we know what to do before we concede? That's my point, is that I don't think you can say that's because we're not resilient. I just don't think we have a very good plan. I don't think we know how we're approaching these games, even at the best of times. I don't think that changes really after we concede.
Yeah.
I think it might change after we concede a third goal, but that to me, that's a different thing.
Spurs, we're doing all right, and then lost it. Bayern, we come out for the second half, do very well,
we lost that before we conceded against Spurs. We came out at the start of the second half and it was already going downhill. Yeah.
There's too many times when this United team have buckled after conceding. Yeah, there isn't resilient. We can agree to disagree, but I just can't see this United team as resilient. I think there is, I know what you mean. There is something there and these last minute goals show it, but if resilience isn't there all the time, it's not resilience. It's just occasional quality and belief and desire.
I don't think resilience is necessarily a yes or no thing. I think it can so you can be more resilient than others or less resilient than others. I just think this is a somewhat resilient team is what I was
saying. Okay, somewhat, yeah. Right, agreed. Pulisic deserves great credit for his role coming on.
Yeah.
Well done to him. I was surprised when I saw he was going to be the substitution. Anyway, let's talk an even bigger picture. We've kind of been on big picture already, but this was yet another kind of kicking on moment, or I think I saw you call it a catalyst for the rest of the season, as in you weren't saying you believed it would be, but it's one of those moments where people say these things, however you want to describe it. But as with Brentford, I've not much faith it will be one because this was bad again. Fulham were rubbish. Do you agree?
Yeah, I've got very little faith that much is going to change, really. It's not to say this isn't important. You know, it keeps things ticking over. It kind of releases that pressure valve a little bit. But I mean, I don't think there was anything in this game that makes you think we're going to be playing any differently over the next five games. We still had very familiar problems, still really, really struggled to break down a Fulham team that really offered very, very little. So yeah, I don't see much changing really.
And I think what did you think of the team selection before I cloud your opinion with my own?
I think every week at the moment, you just get the sense that this is a manager whose ideas about what he's trying to do with this team are very, very cloudy.
Yeah, it just seems muddled. It's like a manager who's clawing at his own job.
Yeah. You know, I didn't understand putting Eriksen in there on his own decision is fine. I didn't understand playing Eriksen in a situation where you're then going to push McTominay high up the pitch alongside Bruno Fernandes, and so leave Eriksen fine as sort of the deepest player in build-up. You know, we've seen that from Ten Hag before. But then also leaving Eriksen very much isolated in defensive transitions, which is already the weakest part of Eriksen's game, with then a centre-back partnership of Maguire and Evans, who themselves aren't the most mobile. You know, it didn't make any sense to me. I didn't really see what the idea or the plan was in that, especially when you have a player in Amrabat on the bench who I don't think is that much worse than Eriksen on the ball and obviously is much more attuned defensively. I don't have massive problems with it on its own. It's so different from what we've seen in every, it seems like every game, especially with midfield, we're trying to do something completely different.
Yeah, I agree with what you said. I think my problems were more from a kind of a fundamentals point of view, where players who had performed appallingly in midweek, like Dalot, are rewarded again with another start. Underperforming players like Anthony, rewarded with a start. When you combine that then with what we spoke about before, last week, that Ten Hag is now starting players we know he doesn't trust and wanted to sell. And in the case of Maguire, I think it's slightly different. In the case of McTominay, it would be different. I think, as we said against City, it would be different if he was starting in that kind of second striker role alongside Højlund. But when he's starting in midfield, we know Ten Hag doesn't trust him there. And yet he's playing him. And when you've got Amrabat, a player he signed and was desperate to sign, Mount, a player he signed and was apparently desperate to sign, Hannibal, who has performed well at every opportunity so far this season, you just see the team selection, you think, and if United have played really well, then obviously we won't be able to say this with hindsight, but you look at it and you think, that is, what is going on in Ten Hag's head? He's trusting players who have let him down or that he doesn't believe are good enough. What are the fans meant to think? And it's part of this wider picture where he doesn't seem... You go back to last season, there seemed such a clarity in what he was saying. And I think this is a difference. We've spoken about how the pragmatism was good last season and how we feel it's bad this season. And obviously it's determined by results. But I've been trying to work out why it feels so much worse, the pragmatism this season. And it's because there's no clarity in the vision behind it. Last season had this thing where Ten Hag would say, right, yeah, we've stopped doing that because I need certain players in certain positions for this. This season, he's not saying that. He's insisting that United are doing well and that he's not. And the problem is, when you're a United manager, you have to be able to handle the media. And I think Ten Hag's handling it okay, but what he's not doing is selling his vision for United anymore, which he did very well last season. And so all we've got left to judge him on is these performances, and they're terrible. This was a really bad performance that we've got away with. There are some fine margins. Had United's goal been allowed, the disallowed one, which it should have done, then maybe this game would have been different. But ultimately, it's football. Mistakes happen. These things happen. You have to adjust. This was a rubbish performance. And so it all just feels part of this wider thing. We just don't know what he's doing anymore. And I think that's why it does. If this had been a poor performance, but we'd seen a team from Ten Hag where he trusted a couple of young players, or we'd seen a setup more akin to what we think he wants to play long term, if he'd done that and it had still been a rubbish performance, but we'd come out with a win, you'd be thinking, okay, this is the begin. This might not be a very pretty beginning, and it might not be pretty for some time, but this is the beginning of us changing and things getting better. But this just feels like another sticking plaster. So
I think part of the issue is, to the first point you made there about players like Hannibal playing well, not getting in the team, like Mount being desperate to sign, not only now not getting in the team, but to not having a clear idea of how to use him right from the beginning. It's unclear to me not only what Ten Hag is trying to achieve, but also sort of on what basis players are being picked and not picked. Because we're clearly not going on sort of past performance and how much credit players have in the bank, because you've got Maguire starting all the time. which is fine. I don't think Maguire's not, Maguire's playing pretty well.
But I do think the Maguire one has to be taken in isolation because there just aren't really any other options. Yes, Varane, but it sounds like there's been a bit of a, it sounds like he wasn't happy at not starting in the derby and maybe he's being punished for that, adding the illness. And so I think Maguire's a little bit different. It's in midfield where I think the issues are, and Dalot at left back where it's most obvious.
Well, and that, it's just, yeah, it doesn't really make any sense that Ten Hag is just chopping and changing his mind all the time. Players don't seem to be getting rewarded for good performances when they do make good performances. You know, a player like Mason Mount, not only not starting games, but also recently barely even coming on and not really featuring much in any of these games. And even when he does, still, it's very unclear to how we want to use him. And I think last year, again, the pragmatism, two things. A, it probably felt better because it was working, which is, we always try to take the outcome out of it, but that's always going to bias how we look at this. But also, I think because it was easier to stomach because, again, it was very clearly this wasn't Ten Hag's team. We were trying to piece things together in a team that only had a few players that he really wanted. But now you're looking at this team and he's made, what, 8, 9 first-team signings? All right, I know they haven't all been available this season, but you've also then got players like Bruno Fernandes, Marcus Rashford, that Ten Hag has clearly sort of signalled that, you know, these are his players that he likes and wants to move forward with. So I think that's, for me, why it's harder to stomach, because it's sort of, I mean, you've had two full pre-seasons, two summer transfer windows where we've spent a lot of money. We haven't spent that very well, but as we know, that is sort of on Ten Hag as well. That, to me, is why the pragmatism isn't, even if we were winning all these games comfortably, I'm sure we'd all feel much better. But I think you'd still feel slightly worried at the lack of identity that was being formed in this team.
And the injuries are crippling. There's no doubt about that. But I think that's why you have to rule out the defence. And we can't talk about Maguire and Evans because obviously that's not what he wants to do, because Shaw and Martinez are injured. Varane's been ill recently. Lindelof was ill for this game. So rule out the defence. But the midfield is such an obvious example of it. And the idea that Mount and Amrabat were on the bench having been signed this summer, it just feels like Ten Hag's lost sight of everything he wanted to do. I can't let the Dalot thing go.
I would like to formally apologise for saying that he was playing relatively well last week and then he turns around and does that against Newcastle.
I was standing inside Old Trafford and thought back to that conversation when it happened. It is the most inexplicable piece of defending I've ever seen.
You know,
watching it
first time around, I thought he just didn't know that Almiron was there. And I was like, that is incredibly stupid. But I can sort of understand maybe the lack of, like, why he was ambling back. But he did. Livramento, when he was breaking forward with the ball, he specifically looks over his shoulder, sees Almiron, and he speeds up for like half a second. And then he just goes back to a light jog again.
That was right. That was right in front of me. So I was standing above the tunnel. So that was at our goal, on our side. I just stood there like heads in hand. I've never seen anything like it. It's like he was match fixing. It was that bad. I'm not suggesting he was, but so bad. And then to start, and he then made a series of other mistakes. So some terrible crosses, some terrible shots. It was one of the worst first half performances I've seen from a player for United. I said at halftime to my brother, that is the kind of, when Gary Neville played that first half against West Brom and retired at halftime in the dressing room.
Yeah.
For a fullback, it was as bad as whatever Neville thought he was doing. It was probably worse. This is why it's so frustrating with Ten Hag this season, because last season, Dalot would just be dropped. He wouldn't play for a month. He'd have to work on that. This season, he's played in his weaker position at left back away at Fulham. You think, how? What's happened? There seems to be this kind of element of ruthlessness left, but most of it is gone. It's, very confusing.
With Reguilon on
exactly,
the bench too.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So you can't blame injuries for that either.
Yeah.
And even then, like Kobbie Mainoo coming back, like why has he not got minutes?
In fairness, I watched, and I'll talk a bit about this game later, the under-21s at Salford in midweek. Mainoo played the full game there a week before. He played 45 minutes against Copenhagen in the UEFA Youth League. When I watched Mainoo on last Tuesday, against Salford, in my head I was thinking, I expect the plan here will be that he'll play on Saturday for the under-21s another full 90 minutes to really make sure he's up to speed, and then he'll travel with the squad, the first team, to Copenhagen. So I was surprised to see him involved and travel with the first team on Saturday, actually. There was a lot of hype around his performance against Salford. He made a couple of assists. Those games are not shown, well, they are shown live on TV, but you have to pay a tenner to watch them because of stupid, ridiculous EFL rules. So a lot of hype on Twitter about his performance when most people hadn't actually watched him play. He was good, but he wasn't incredible. I would just put that out there. It was a good midfield performance. He's just come back from injury. So sorry to interrupt, but
But I mean, Maidu being a standout for the under-21s isn't anything, new, really. Even if he was incredible, we know he's very, very good at that level. I don't really understand what Ten Hag is rewarding in players. It seems like the pecking order shifts from week to week.
I think Hannibal's the stranger one.
And even then, then I think Mount comes into it too, because Hannibal and Mount are to some degree competing for the same position. And to be fair, I don't think either of them have done a lot wrong. Hannibal's probably been more positive than Mount when he's come in. But I wouldn't be, if it was Mount playing over Hannibal, I wouldn't be that upset. You know, big signing from the summer, trying to get him figured out in the team and where you want to play him. You would have assumed that Ten Hag had that plan in place already from the summer. But now neither of them are playing.
Yeah. I mean, the concern is that, well, ultimately, I think basically Ten Hag's gone for height and power. And that's why McTominay. Well,
and like you said last week, just trying to get the goal scorers on the pitch. I think we're so lacking in goals that McTominay is genuinely seen as the best way for us to create chances.
Yeah, and he did score and should have had a goal. Good cross from Garnacho for that as well. It'll go kind of unnoticed because
Garnacho was one of the few positives all game.
Oh, there was that lovely run when he came inside and he thought, is he going to do another Ronaldo at Craven Cottage here? He was good.
Yeah.
He was good. Anthony was terrible, and we'll talk a bit about him in the Patreon Q&A. Before we go to one more thing, we're meant to do this a while ago. Guess the player clue one, please.
I was very resilient. No, I'm joking. first clue is I played under David Moyes in two different spells as a player, one of them at United.
Okay. My immediate thoughts are, Fellaini is one obvious one. I'm not going to, there's a few others like Yanisai and but I'm not going to guess yet, but okay.
Okay.
The final thing I wanted to talk about, Maguire, who was excellent, quality in the air. And I think that's the thing you really notice with him compared to Verona Martinez, is just constantly winning those aerial battles. And it's partly because we're playing differently, so we're conceding more crosses. So it's much more noticeable than I think we were last season. But yeah, he's great at that. He also played some lovely passes through the lines or diagonals. I thought, again, he was good. But he did look in trouble. And I was concerned watching him because the evidence is overwhelming about head injuries in football. And football is very willing to turn a blind eye to it. I wrote a piece about this for United We Stand a couple of months ago. One of the interviewees for my book about the men who made Manchester United, one of the characters is Charlie Roberts. Charlie Roberts founded the Players Union, what became the PFA. He founded that alongside Billy Meredith, the United player, in December 1907. About 30 years on, 32 years on, Charlie Roberts died of a head injury after operation on a head injury related to heading the football. You've now seen pretty much the entire 1968 European Cup winning team at United and 1966 World Cup winning team of England die with dementia or CTE. Nobby Stiles has been proved to have CTE, which is a condition affected by heading the ball and brought on by that. His son, John Stiles, has spoken about it a lot. When I interviewed, I speak to Charlie Roberts' grandson semi-regularly, and I asked him about Maguire, not this time, but about a season ago, discussing this, and he says he winces every time he sees Harry Maguire head the ball for United because he knows what it's doing to his brain. And it's a conversation football is very unwilling to have because it's not just about concussion. It's literally just about heading the ball is going to cause most footballers to have dementia earlier than they might otherwise have, or to have it when they otherwise wouldn't have it. And Maguire looked in trouble in that game. And I don't know. You kind of have to trust the club doctors and the regulations, but there should be a concussion substitute, and that idea was rejected recently. But if there'd been a concussion substitute available there, so the concept is Maguire would have come off after that early knock. He'd be able to be assessed for 10 or 15 minutes. If he's fine, and they know he's fine. He can come back on. If he's not, he has to come off. But football doesn't have that yet. And it's like, it's endangering these people's lives. It's, I don't know what you thought watching it, but for the whole game, every time he headed the ball, I thought, oh God, what's he doing to himself?
Yeah, I was incredibly shocked that Maguire stayed on the pitch. I really was. I mean, it looked bad enough from the very beginning, and he came on, got checked. I'm guessing was cleared if he was given a proper concussion test at all. I'm assuming that he was. I think there's a few issues here. One is the concussion substitute, obviously, because, I mean, it's just a no-brainer to allow that to players.
No pun intended.
To protect and players' health. Yeah. But the other one, I think, for me, is also bringing in independent doctors to do the concussion review as well. Because, look, I'm not for a second going to sit here and say that I don't trust the club doctors at Man United or any other club. You know, they are doctors doing everything to the best of their ability. But there is a clear conflict of interest potential when you have a club deciding for themselves whether a player has a concussion and needs to be replaced, even with a concussion substitute. Because let's say it was Maguire today and Varane wasn't on the bench. You can very clearly see where that conflict lies, where, you know, Ten Hag and everyone else in the Man United coaching staff, they don't have Harry Maguire's long-term brain health in their head when they're making that decision. They have winning that game. And so I also think it needs independent doctors to be making these assessments. And if they feel that someone needs a concussion check, it's them to make that decision, and that gets communicated to the coaching staff, and then a substitution is mandated. That shouldn't be left down to club doctors, because even them as individuals doing things to the best of their ability, it's not just their decision. And it needs independent doctors there to be able to force managers to make these substitutions to protect the health of players.
Yeah. I spoke to John Stiles about this a few months ago in summer. And he said he thinks the kind of cover up of the danger around footballers' brain health will be, when uncovered, will be as big a story as like Big Tobacco in Britain, which is interesting. It's a story I want to look at a lot more. I've not had the time to delve into it as much as I would have liked. And like I did Paddy Crowan's column for the program for a while, and I asked him about it, and he said, yeah, he was aware of it, but footballers are very reticent to talk about it because I can understand why, because you realize that they're basically discussing possibly their own deaths. So, and John Stiles says he tries to go to training grounds, but lots of clubs ban him, including in the Women's Super League. I asked him, do you think women's football maybe can be the route into this because it's a more open environment? They're more willing to change and listen to other opinions. And he said, no, I contacted every WSL club and they wouldn't have me in to speak to the players. He basically tries to educate players and speak to them and say, look, his argument is footballers have to know the dangers. And if they then want to carry on playing and they're aware of those dangers, that's fine. But they have to know them. And at the moment, they're kept in the dark about how dangerous it is heading the ball as often as they do, not just in matches, but primarily in training, where there are some regulations. But footballers don't want to know about it because they think their career's short. They want to achieve success, and they will think about it maybe when they're 60 or 70. And maybe they'll regret it. Some of them won't. But it's a really sad issue. But one that I think will get more coverage in the next couple of years. There's some ongoing court cases, I think, between the FA, PFA, John Stiles, and many people. it will be a big story in the next couple of years. I'm sure of that. Right, before we go into a Patreon Q&A, can we have guests to play clue two?
Yes. So clue number two is, I am the son of a diplomat whose work meant that I moved from my country of birth first to Belgium and later to France.
That really rings a bell. Let me have a think about that over the Patreon Q&A, because I know that story, but I can't remember. I can't remember exactly whether it's the person.
Well, a couple of the names you mentioned were Belgian. You think it's either of them?
Mm. I I'm unwilling to say as things stand. I don't want to. let me think over the Patreon Q&A. In the Patreon Q&A, we're going to talk about what the best and worst case scenario for United as a club is by the end of the season. We'll talk about Antony. We're going to talk about VAR. You may notice we haven't discussed it yet. It's been a horrendous weekend for VAR. We'll talk a bit about it in there. We'll talk about our favourite and least favourite pundits, and we'll be talking about a starting lineup for the Copenhagen game. After the Patreon Q&A and after the ad break for normal subscribers, we'll have an academy briefing, and then we'll have Guest of Player Crew 3 and potentially my guest before that, and we'll have a Copenhagen match preview. So let's dive into the respective breaks for all of you.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Coming out of the Patreon Q&A, lovely conversation there about all sorts, some really interesting stuff on Antony, on VAR, on our favourite and least favourite pundits, on why United aren't scoring as many goals this season, and the best and worst case for the club so far. If you want to hear that Patreon Q&A, you can. You can sign up from as little as £1.50 a month. Go to our Twitter at UTD Weekly Pod for information about how to do that. You'll get a bonus Q&A, you get ad-free episodes, you'll get early release episodes, lots of things, and you get to be part of the Manchester United Weekly Podcast community and support what we do, because we've been doing it for 9 seasons now. And yeah, all support is very much appreciated. Let's have a quick academy briefing, starting with the fact that the under-21s beat Everton 3-1 on Saturday lunchtime. Joe Hugo scored twice, Shola Shoretiri once. As I mentioned earlier, I was at Salford City for the EFL Trophy game. United went ahead in that game, composed finish from Shoretiri. I think there's some fireworks going off in the background on Bonfire Night weekend. So apologies if you can hear them. Shoretiri put United ahead in that game. Then two long-range efforts from Salford got them in front. Pretty poor defending, passive defending from United for that. Good starts the second half, scored twice. Amari Forson and Shoretiri there to go 3-2 ahead. Some great celebrations in front of the United end. In the end, Salford scored two late penalties to win that game and knock United out of the EFL Trophy group stages. Great learning experience for the players. And as a fan, just lovely to be there. Those nights feel like United's core support gathers, and you get a lot of old chants. You get people meeting up, having not seen each other for a long time, a relaxed environment, but still this opportunity to see potentially future United players and to give those young players the support. So that was lovely to be at. And it's a shame there won't be another EFL Trophy game, because United are knocked out, having beaten Stockport County on penalties after 1-1 draw, lost 8-1 at Bolton Wanderers, which is a really intense thumping. Some lessons learnt there. And then 4-3 at Salford. In other news, Shay Lacy has an injury which rules him out of the upcoming Under-17 World Cup. United Under-18's captain, Philly McAllister, is in the squad, so good luck to him. And the Under-19s have a crucial game against Copenhagen in the UEFA Youth League this week. Kind of need a result to have a chance of progressing. A draw could be helpful. A win would be incredible. Copenhagen are a really good team, but their best player was injured a couple of weeks ago. Jack, guess the player clue 3. I think I know the answer. You're just going to have to trust me when I tell you the truth after, but give clue 3 first, and then we'll have the answer right at the end of the show.
Clue 3 is I provided one of the best moments of David Moyes' season in charge at Man United at the Allianz Arena against Bayern.
Okay, yeah. I had the correct answer, but I'll leave that floating there for everyone else in case they've not got it right until the end. Copenhagen. Tony Ryan says, what would your starting lineup for Copenhagen be knowing that we have to win? Do you want to tackle this one first? I should start by saying, I think whatever starting lineup United play, we'll lose.
I think I would go Onana, Wan-Bissaka, Maguire, Varane, assuming that whatever's going on with Varane is fixed, because it seems like there is some sort of issue behind the scenes there. And then Reguilon at left back. Would you, any changes from that?
Yeah, no, agreed.
Then in midfield, I'd probably go, I want to say Amrabat, Mount, Bruno Fernandes. It's probably what I would do, but I really don't think that Ten Hag will do that.
Yeah, but don't worry about what Ten Hag will do. Just go with.
I would probably do that or put Hannibal in there instead of Mount.
Okay. Yeah. With Højlund, Rashford, Garnacho.
Or even Pellistri.
Yeah. I think Pellistri is going to be a lot better off the bench. I think he needs a few bench substitute appearances first. So I'd probably go Garnacho. But then you're looking at Garnacho on the right. A sort of Ahmad looks like he's close to coming back, which will be a real boost for our options on the right wing. Overall, Copenhagen, any confidence? The atmosphere at the park and stadium is intense. And we know how United players deal with atmospheres like that. And it's not a good response. So I'm not particularly confident.
I always feel weirdly confident. The last few games, I feel like every time I'm like, maybe this is the day where we just win 4-0. And obviously it never happens.
The life of a football fan, eh?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's an odd one because I think normally going into games like this, you sort of think, I think it'll be hard and it won't be fun to watch, but eventually the difference in quality will shine through. But I guess I don't have too much faith that United will actually do that this year from all the evidence that we've had so far. I think, but basically, I think I could see United having some real trouble in the first 20 minutes or so, to be fair, as we did against Copenhagen at home. And I think if we can weather that storm, we could be okay, but I think it's going to be a really, really uncomfortable 90 minutes. To be honest, I think all of the remaining Champions League games are going to be incredibly uncomfortable as fans because it's Galatasaray away after this, which is an equally hostile, if not even more hostile atmosphere. And then we play Bayern at home, which is obviously easier to do at home, but against a very, very good side.
Yeah, I think we have to win. I think we'll lose at Galatasaray.
Yeah, 100%.
I'm looking forward to the trip. Going Monday to Thursday. In fact, if anyone's going to be in Copenhagen or any Danish listeners are listening, I'll be speaking on the, I think it's the Denmark Manchester United Supporters Club, part of the Scandinavian Supporters Club, their podcast at the, I think it's called the Den Glade Gris, the Happy Pig Pub, on Tuesday evening. So I'll be chatting there if you'd like to come along to, it's a live recording. And I'm told they have very cheap beer compared to most of Copenhagen. So that might swing it for you. If anyone's in Copenhagen and wants to meet up for a pint, let me know at Twitter, HarryRobin64, sorry. Yeah, it's a lovely city. I've been once before. It will be, I'm imagining it will be fairly cold. Not confident about the game, but it'll be a great place to go to and I'm looking forward to it. And I might go to the UEFA Youth League game as well because Copenhagen have a really good team. They're said to be one of the favourites for the tournament overall. Like Bayern, it's a really strong UEFA Youth League group United are in this season. So they'll need a really good performance there. Guess the player. I guess after two clues was Patrice Evra. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. Played under David Moyes for half a season at West Ham before retiring.
Yeah, it took me a while to remember that because I was kind of thinking United players that Moyes had worked with first at Everton. And then I feel like we've had kind of a similar clue to that before, which is
I think you've given me Fellaini.
Yeah, before. I think I have, yeah.
And I think I gave you one about Zaha, about him working with Solskjaer as well.
Yes. Yeah. Patrice Evra. Good man. And on that note, let's wrap up.
I didn't know that he moved to Belgium before France. I'd heard the diplomat story. But I didn't know he went to Belgium.
That's the other thing that threw me. And then I thought, I can't think of another son of a diplomat, so I'm going to go for it. Fascinating career and person. And all round good guy now. Yeah, let's wrap up. Thank you for listening, everyone. Fascinating conversations. Hope you've enjoyed the episode. If you have, share it on Twitter or leave us a review or sign up to be a patron. But for now, for more throughout the week from Jack, you can find him on Twitter at
UTDTait, T-A-I-T.
And you can find me at HarryRobertson64 on the podcast itself at UTD Weekly Pod. And a reminder, another way to support me, not necessarily the podcast, but to support me is to buy my book, The Men Who Made Manchester United, which is out now. If you've bought it already, thank you so much. I hope you're enjoying it. And on that note, we will wrap up. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Goodbye.
Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.